When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to More Than Amused Podcast. My name is Sadie.
And I'm Stani, and welcome back.
It's like been a while since we've recorded together.
Yeah,
just
it has.
Because
it feels
we,
like a really long time.
Yeah, we batched the recorded like last week's episode. We skipped the week before. So, wow, I'm so happy to be back recording another episode.
I feel like there's so much we have to catch up on.
I know.
First off, okay, we'll talk about Taylor in a minute, but like,
amazing.
How do you feel about Olivia Rodrigo's Vampire? Because I haven't talked to you since that came out.
Oh my gosh, it has been a while since we've talked. Oh man, yeah. Our weekly recordings is like our weekly catch-up sessions. So without it, oh no, I really like Vampire.
Same.
Yes, it didn't grip me quite as much as Driver's License did. I'm not as obsessed with it, but I really like it, and I'm really excited for the album.
Love that. I feel like it's opposite for me. I'm more obsessed with this one than I am with Driver's License.
Wow.
Yeah. But I really can't wait for the album.
I think the album's going to be really good.
And just like the building, I feel like she does a really good job of like even her ballads end up kind of becoming rock songs. Mm-hmm. And I just really, really enjoy that.
I think what she did really well was I think that calling the song Vampire and like using that theme, it had the potential to get cheesy and overdone. Mm-hmm. But I think she really walked that line like perfectly.
Yeah. Like I was a little worried it was going to come across as like too mystical sort of and like a little cheesy. But she made it work really, really well.
Yeah, she did. I really liked it a lot.
No, it was great.
At first, when I heard the next album named Two Guts, I didn't like it.
Yeah.
But the more I'm hearing it, the more I'm like, okay, that's actually a cool title. I actually kind of like that it's an ugly word. I think there's a lot of like emotional responses to that word, so I think it's cool.
Yeah, and I kind of like the theme she's going for with like the one word impact, sour guts. My only issue with it is I saw someone mention that, like, the cover art does kind of look like it could just be the back for the Sour album.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I agree. Like, I kind of wish she would have done something a little bit
more creative.
Yeah. Like, I'm fine with sticking with the purple. I think that's fun. And it's, like, a theme that she's keeping to. And I enjoy that. I feel like it fits her really well.
Mm-hmm.
But, I don't know. She could have branched out a little bit more.
I agree. And I've seen, like, other pictures that were taken for it that I feel like also could have worked for the cover arts, like, from the photo shoot. So
that's fair.
Have you seen the one where she's, like, leaning against the wall and there's, like, a lamp in the headboard?
That.
I think that's so cool.
The one for the vinyl. I think they're doing one of them, too.
I like the rings. I think it's cool how she's incorporating the title in her jewelry, but I agree. It's just not really it doesn't scream album cover to me. So
no, it's even if they would have cropped it in a little tighter, maybe I'd feel different. But it's just like, I don't know. It's so small.
I fully agree. But speaking of, Taylor's version did also come out.
Yes. Taylor Swift. I love that woman.
I
really, truly do.
I also love that woman.
I will say, like, I was kind of not expecting a lot. Like, I like Speak Now.
Me
I
too.
Really do. Like, quite a few songs on it I really love. But the thing with the re-records for me is that it's, like, it's not going to change, really, like, how often I listen to those songs, probably.
I'll just replace
them.
Mm-hmm.
But these vault tracks were surprising.
In a good way or a bad way?
Kind of both.
Yeah, okay.
Like, there's some that I, like, really love, and they're definitely going to be on my new rotation. And then there were some of them where I was just kind of like, okay.
Yeah, honestly, this is my least favorite vault. I feel like with the Fearless and the Red vaults, there were a couple songs in each that I was like, how did these not make the original album? Red more so than Fearless. Like, listening to the Red Vault tracks, I would have loved I Bet You Think About Me. I would have loved Better Man, which, yeah, I know Little Big Town released it, but I would have loved it originally on the Red album. I would have loved Nothing New. Like, there's so many from that vault track that I would have loved to have, especially with, and with Fearless, Mr. Perfectly Fine. That was the obvious one.
That one deserved to be on the album.
Yes.
Like, it's actually crazy to me that that didn't make it. Mm-hmm. And I understand why that one's such a major hit, because, yeah.
It's so good. With the Speak Now, I was like, good call, Taylor. You picked the right track list. Like, I didn't necessarily miss any of these. I'm glad that I can hear them now, but I didn't miss them from the original track list. And I feel bad for saying that, because I'm seeing a lot of people online loving all the new Vault tracks and saying it's the best Vault. No.
I don't think it's the best.
I don't think so either.
I Can See You surprised me.
I like I Can See You.
I listened to it the first time and I was kind of like, what? I think, like, sometimes the music videos hit differently. I think it's because I really appreciate the narrative that she tells. And then once the narrative's attached, then I, like, appreciate a song a lot more.
Yeah, I get that.
So once I saw the music video for I Can See You, it's, like, more of a bop now.
That makes sense. I just feel like I Can See You is Taylor's hottest song maybe ever. So who would have thought that her hottest song was written in the Speak Now era and was just chilling in that vault? So good for her.
Oh man. And the music video, speaking of that, is incredible.
Taylor Lautner, everything is love. Like, nature is healing, you know?
It is, definitely. He's pretty much her most non-problematic ex.
Yeah.
I mean, people would get mad at me for putting him over Harry Styles, but.
Or Joe Jonas. He's been all right, right?
Now.
That's true. He did break up with her in like a 27-second phone call. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think like Taylor Lautner has never been problematic. And he's done a lot of like, I listened to a podcast interview because he started a podcast with his wife where they talk about mental health.
Mm-hmm.
And so he went on a podcast, Chicks in the Office, to like promote it and everything. And of course, they talked about like Taylor and everything too. But he brought up that his one regret was that he didn't do anything about the Kanye situation.
Yeah, and, like, defend I saw her. That.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he thought it was, like, a joke. He didn't realize it was real until she turned around. And that's, like, one thing that's always haunted him a little. And so it was really cool to see him get to be the hero in this, you know, like, little fictional space where he actually got to swoop in and, like, save her in some way.
And, like, the way he would have maybe wanted to in that moment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sweet. And also his wife is, like, a major fan.
Yeah.
And so she got to go hang out with them and everything. And, like...
I was talking about it with my husband after. And just about the fact that, like, what would we do if... Like, if Taylor Swift was your husband's ex.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you deal with that as a woman? In a way, you know, because it's like,
yeah,
your ex is the best person ever. Why are you with me? I don't know.
I think you have to look at it as like, there's obviously a reason why they broke up.
Yes.
From back to the December, it kind of sounds like she was a little bit more in the wrong.
Yeah. And I mean, at this point, too, it was 13 years ago.
Yes. And they were really young. And he was going through a lot. He's talked about the pressure he was under with like Twilight, and how he was like 17, and then all these people were like thirsting after him.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you hit a certain point, your body starts changing, and then you got a bunch of crap about that.
Yeah.
So I don't know, they were in completely different places.
Completely different. But also, listening to the original songs, I think the production sounds awesome on all of them, and her vocals sound great. So
yeah,
it was actually really fun and really nostalgic to listen to.
Oh, and here's another controversy. I'm not mad about the Better Than Revenge rewrite.
Oh, yeah. I'm actually not either. When I first heard it, I will admit I was disappointed. I wanted to scream a horrible line. But I went on a run this morning listening to the album. Also, yes, I went on a run. I would like to go on record that that is not a habitual thing of mine. It was the first run I've been on in forever. And I walked most of it. Besides the point. But I flashed back to a moment where I would sing Better Than Revenge about a girl that I was pissed at for talking to my boyfriend, and how much I, like, personally had weaponized that line. And I was like, that was horrible. It's a good thing she changed it.
Yeah. And, like, she didn't change the nature of the girl by changing that line.
No.
She just didn't slut shame her.
Mm-hmm.
She just changed it. Wow, she's powerful and manipulative, and that's how she got him.
Exactly. Like, it didn't change the narrative of the song at all.
Which I was worried she was going to do that. based yes. on a lot of feedback. But I have seen some pretty funny parodies of people coming up with other lines. I think my favorite was, she's something, a doctor, and her patients are suing for malpractice.
Nice. I have not seen that one, but that's hilarious. Yeah.
So I've seen some pretty hilarious ones. I will give people that, but I don't understand the outrage.
I get that it's like the nostalgia, you know, whatever. I felt it. I was pissed. I definitely texted someone in the moment of like, no, I can't believe it. I got over it really quickly, and I'm like, all right. Good call, Taylor. You did the right thing. Good call. Fair. Anything else we need to touch on?
I'm sure there's something. I'm dying that the Barbie movie is coming out soon, so that's consuming so much of my thoughts.
I'm so excited to watch it.
Same.
But anyways, who are we learning about today? I have no idea who we're covering.
Yeah, we are talking about Beatrix Ferrand. I think I'm saying that right.
Cool.
So how I found her is actually kind of fun. Last Christmas, I was picking out presents for my family, and I wanted to get my mom, like, a gardening book, because my mom's a landscape designer. And so I started looking at all these gardening books, and then I realized that they were all, like, about men or, like, written by men, and that rubbed me wrong. We've talked a lot about how important it is to have, like, role models or, like, people in your industry that you can look up to that are your gender, you know, you relate to them more. It's why diversity is really important as well. So you have someone of like your race.
Yeah, it's nice to see everything. Yourself in your heroes.
Yes, that's why it's so important to have diversity in that. So I went on this whole like little research thing to try and find a female landscape designer. And I found one, and she's really cool. So yay. I was like, okay. And then I was like, here's this book. Also, I'll do an episode on her. So,
and we've not done a landscape designer, so
we haven't. And it is like a major thing. It's known as like landscape architecture or landscape design, kind of depends on if you have like the degree or not. Because in order to call yourself like an architect, you have to have like the degree. So if something goes wrong,
yes,
whatever, I don't know. But my mom doesn't handle like the architecture part of it, which sometimes brings in like garden beds and stairs and waterfalls and that kind of jazz. Yes. She just handles the design. So kind of depends on what you're doing. So landscape architects and designers are actually really rare for women to be. Apparently it was like extremely controversial for women to go into that field. And that includes like architecture, which we have covered, a female architect. But during the Great Depression, the idea was that it was too tedious of a physical job for women. Mm. They're like, you can't survey sites, which is weird to me. We've talked about this so many times. That like gardening is considered a perfectly acceptable female pastime. Same with like cooking. But then the minute a woman tries to do it professionally, all of a sudden she no longer belongs there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't understand it.
Over and over.
I'm like, okay, so now that she wants to get paid, it's not okay?
I mean, yes, exactly, which is annoying.
It is very annoying. So it became kind of a more popular job after the 1960s, obviously, with the women's rights movement. People began really paying more attention to the landscape because of, like, environmental factors. So female landscape architects kind of continued and started playing a more vital role. What's really cool about Beatrix Ferrand is she actually came before that. She died in 1956, so right before the 1960s.
Yeah, wow.
Which makes her like a really pivotal part of like switching mindsets, I think. Mm-hmm. And she's largely considered the only woman to have ever been accepted into the American Society of Landscape Architects.
Wow.
Yes. So that's who we're talking about. Okay, so Beatrix Cadwalder Jones was born in New York City on June 19th, 1872, into a family that was considered to be five generations of gardeners.
Wow.
Love that.
Also,
I just think it's cute.
I'm like, that is a long time ago then that they were gardeners.
Yes. Her mother was Mary Cadwalder Rowell. And her father was a lawyer, William Henry Rowell. They also like to put in everything that her father was the brother of novelist Edith Wharton.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I think we've maybe mentioned her.
Yeah, I was gonna say that name sounds very, very familiar.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm sure she's come up. She was an American writer and designer and wrote some books around the Gilded Age area, and she was also the first woman to win a Pulitzer Prize.
Oh, cool.
In fiction. She wrote the novel Age of Innocence.
Mm-hmm.
Very popular. So yeah, so that was her aunt, which is really cool.
That is cool.
She was very conscious of plants from a very early time. Her grandmother had a rose garden at her house in Newport, Rhode Island, and she would take her out into the garden and teach her how to cut off dead flowers. Oh, and when beautiful. She was only like 4 or 5, because you have to do that with rose bushes, you know, go yeah. out and trim them. And so she would go and wander after her grandmother in an early age and learned the names of many of the roses at a very young age.
That sounds very wholesome yeah. and magical.
And they said it continued even into when she was older. She would point out roses by name and be aww. Like, oh, those are my these are my these. Like, very I love cute. That. She spent a lot of time at Rhode Island with her grandmother, as well as her family had a summer home in Wreath Point Estate in Mount Desert Island, Maine. So very, like, East Coast. And it sounds like they were pretty well off.
I was like, East Coast wealthy?
Yeah. There's nothing in here about, like, her parents' station. But I mean, like, her dad was a lawyer.
I can fill in the blanks.
Yeah. They had a summer home.
Like. Yeah. Okay. Oh, her aunt was like a big famous author. Yeah. Okay.
The yep. minute they mentioned that someone has more than one house, I'm like, okay, you're in a different tax bracket.
Yeah. Like, we are playing different games here, and that's, yeah. that's all right.
So she went by Trix a lot, too, when she was younger, which is very cute. What ended up kind of changing her life? She had a fortunate meeting, is what they call it, with Mrs. Charles Sprague Sargent, who was an artist who made drawings for her husband's collection of American woods in the American Museum of Natural History, which sounds very intriguing. But she invited her to join Halm Lee in Brooklyn, where she met Professor Sargent, the first director of the Arnold Arboretum. Mm-hmm. And he was really interested in the fact that she was interested in plants. And then was like, you should study landscape gardening. That's all it takes sometimes.
Just someone to put the idea in your head to be like, oh, that's a thing. Yeah, oh, I like, would like that.
You like this. You should do this. And uh-huh. then you're like, oh my gosh, you're right. I should do that.
I mean, isn't that how graphic design became a thing for you?
Yes. It was my mom, actually. She said, wow, you really like this. You should do graphic design. And I went, wait, what's graphic design? And here we are.
Here so, we are, full-time graphic designer.
That's all it takes sometimes. He even offered to throw the facilities of the arboretum open for her, which was a major thing, especially because she was a woman.
Yeah.
And for months, she was the grateful guest of Mrs. Sargent and the hardworking pupil of Professor Sargent at the arboretum.
Oh, cool.
This did a lot for her. Obviously, she learned a ton. But then he also went, hey, I got you a professional job.
Oh, nice.
Yep. And she said, I'm not ready. And he smiled and answered that she must learn while working for clients. And so he set out for her first professional job to do some tree thinning and remodel a little planting on a garden on a slope. Like a little garden job.
That sounds very nice.
Right? And this was when she was only like 20. So very young.
Mm-hmm.
Also a woman. You know, like this is a very big deal. And it's just really nice to find people who are willing to champion people with talent.
Totally.
Regardless of bias at the time. So very wonderful. Also, I don't think I mentioned the reason he was a professor. He actually was the professor of horticulture at the Bussey Institute and the founding director of the Arnold Arboretum, which is actually on Harvard's grounds.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So that's where she was learning. She was in the arboretum on Harvard.
All right. That seems significant. Yeah.
He also named a species of plant after her, Cretaceous Jonesae, after her maiden name.
Cute.
And because she was the one who noticed it and brought it to his attention. And so when he discovered it, he named it after her.
I love that.
It's like leaves. Okay. Explain it. Cool. Like a leafing plant. It's probably like branches or something is kind of what it looks like.
Cool. That makes sense.
Sorry, guys. I'm not a plant person. I don't know. But anyway, that was named after her.
Cool.
There also was no designated school for landscape gardening at the time. So that's why it was another important thing that she had such a close relationship with the professor to learn from him. And under tutelage with him, she learned drafting to scale, which is really important for landscape gardening and architecture.
Mm-hmm.
Also elevation rendering, which is also a huge thing. You're dealing with hills, cliff sides, varying elevations. You have to know surveying, which is basically when you're out on the ground, like how to measure and draw it out, and engineering. And then she also was a major proponent for using native plant species, which is a huge practice now, especially. And then she liked to study a lot of books on it. She got to travel abroad and see gardens across the world to learn from, and learned from other places and other people how important it was to have natural plants in your natural area, which makes perfect sense. But yeah, everyone plants grass everywhere, so what do we know?
Very true. Yeah.
One thing she really learned from him is he had this advice where you make the plan fit the ground and not twist the ground to fit the plan.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
Yeah, is wonderful. I actually wish we followed that a lot more, where it's like, instead of just like cutting directly through stuff, kind of let the ground exist as it is and plan around it. And then also he advised her to study the tastes of the owner, also to look at great paintings, to observe and analyze natural beauty, to travel widely in Europe and see all the gardens she could, and learn from all of the great arts, as all art is akin.
I like that.
Love that.
Yeah.
Part of the reason why we do this, I feel like they all intersect so beautifully. So she got to go to Italy, France, Germany, Holland, England, and Scotland. She studied all the gardens. My parents actually just went on a European garden tour to England, Amsterdam, and France. So I know that those are all
beautiful,
huge, very important gardens are all there. Notably like Monet.
Oh, you know, whatever. Who's that?
Painted his own gardens. Uh-huh. You also have the Versailles in France with Marie Antoinette. Those were like very notable. Uh-huh. And then you also have like Buckingham Palace and all the royalty of England and their beautiful English gardens. So there's cool. Some really important gardens abroad. Then when she returned, more work came to her, and she ended up meeting Mrs. Moses Taylor Pine, who eventually took her to Princeton and then introduced her to university work, which became a large part of all of her professional jobs and careers. So all these chance meetings with women who helped her out.
My one thought on the chance meetings is that, I mean, it's like kind of like the Nepo babies of today, you know, where it just seems like her family was very connected. And I'm not shaming people for that. I wouldn't shame a Nepo baby, you know. It's just she was in a great situation for her talents. And thank goodness, because enough women from that time period were not in good positions. Yeah. So I'm so glad she was.
Now, I feel like we've talked about this a lot. A lot of the women we've talked about are pretty much Nepo babies.
Yeah.
Like, even the first two we covered, Clara Schumann, Artemisia Gentileschi. Like, they had connections. That's what made them able to succeed in areas that are dominated by men.
But it was, like, the only way they could do it.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. And why, how that's, like, really cool in a lot of ways.
No, it really is.
And I know it is unfortunate, because there would be a lot more artists if we didn't have to rely on that were women. But
we'll take what we can get. No shame
there. Yes. Yeah. We'll take it. You should accept like and take any advantage you can get. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. Another fortunate meeting led to a happy marriage with Max Ferrand. He was actually an accomplished historian at the Stanford and Yale universities and the first director of the Huntington Library. Very prominent position. They weren't really young at that point. They both were very distinguished in their careers. And so they agreed. This sounds so like cute to me and like so mature and good that they were like, we're gonna agree to go ahead with our professional careers and just let this marriage enrich our lives.
I like that sentiment. Yes.
Yes. And they stuck true to that. Getting married didn't really influence her career at all, but it like made her happy.
Yeah.
And same with him. There was some like loops that they had to go through a little bit. Like, I think I'll get to it. She did end up moving to an area because of his job, but like it worked out, you know, like things happen. So
we're gonna take a quick break just to spotlight one of our new favorite women artists.
So today for spotlights, I am shouting out a TikTok actor, or just one of those people who do like the funny POV cringe characters. This person, her TikTok is Delaney Says Hello. And her Instagram is her name, which is just Delaney Rowe. So if you don't like TikTok, she reposts, I think, a lot of what she does on TikTok right on her Instagram. So
it looks like it.
Yeah, you can go still see her videos. But she's so funny and she does such a good job. I think like she does a lot of like the insufferable female leads of an indie movie, and like
I was just looking at the female detective in every movie written by a man.
She's also like done one like the female bartender in every movie written by a man. And I, you know what, we'll make this like tie it into what we do here on the episode, but I think she just does a really great job of truly capturing how silly it is that men, like the ways men will write women characters.
Yeah.
And in like superhero movies she's done, like said, the bartender, all of it. But she does also, you know, poke fun at a lot of things and like a lot of indie movies. So she makes me laugh so hard. She does this like ongoing thing of like girl who's convinced you're absolutely obsessed with her. And it just, I just think she's hilarious. I love her. And she's, like I said, she does like a really good job. I think sometimes like with like the TikTok actors, you're like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Whatever. I think she's hilarious.
Hey, so. No shade. There's people getting full blown careers off of TikTok acting.
True. And so. I need this girl. I'm like, Hollywood, put her in business. I feel like she would do a good job.
I think we talked about the one girl who always does like the rom-coms. Like, yes. She makes little mini rom-coms. What is her username? We've spotlighted her before.
Yeah, I love her, but I don't know. I can't remember her name right now.
Yeah, I don't remember either. She did like the Man of Pixie Dream Girl one, a bunch of stuff, but she ended up getting cast in like a rom-com. And everyone was like, it's so weird to see you in a rom-com with an actual boy instead of yourself.
True. I love it. That's like my favorite brand of, or like favorite segment of TikTok right now is like the POVs, like from movies, like the TikTok actors. Like,
yes.
That's honestly all I really want to see right now. So go check her out. Funny. Her name's Delaney Rowe.
Awesome. Okay. I have one I found on TikTok too. And cool. Actually, it was such a wholesome one that I found. So it was her in like all these outfits, and she's like, I want to be a fashion designer when I grow up. And it had her in these like crazy outfits and like all this stuff. And then it showed her like professional clothing designs that she's done like on models for her runway show. Mm-hmm. And first off, they're cool. Like, I would never wear any of these because I'm not cool enough. Yeah, I know. They're so cool. So she owns a clothing brand. It's called Zoe Grinfield, or like Zoe.
Oh, yeah. Grinfield.
It's on TikTok as the same thing. It's Zoe Grinfield.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Artist and fashion designer. She's got like hats that have charms all over them. Like I said, I'm not cool enough to wear any of this stuff, but man, I really love looking at it.
But they're so fun.
Yeah, it's so cool. So they have like a whole lineup of charm hats where just like the brim has charms all over them.
Oh no, there's a pink flower charm hat. I want it.
She made like a coat out of Barbie head, like hair.
Oh, that, okay, the hair part is oh, I see it now. That's a little scary, but I mean, I get it.
But it looks cool.
Yeah, it does.
One of the ones I love is like, I think it's called the Lost and Found collection that she did. So they like tied in toys and everything to it. But one of the ones I love is actually at the top of her page. It's like a mesh top and it just has jewelry like all over it. It's so pretty.
I am loving this. I'm like now on her website looking at like the lookbook. Yeah. And just like all of her different things.
I just love how creative it all is.
It's like real life. Like, I don't know. It's like a Netflix show, you know, like the fashion design or like, what's it? Project Runway. There it is.
Yes, definitely. My favorite thing too, for each look that she did on her Instagram, she includes like a little collage page that kind of like explains it.
That is cool.
And the collage pages are also beautiful. Like, yeah. You can tell she's just one of those people who like live breathes her work.
Yeah.
And I love that.
I love it too.
They're just cool.
Well, thank you for sharing this person with me. I'm obsessed with her art now.
Same. Like, if anything, like, go follow, support, because how cool.
All right, now back to the show.
After she started like professionally, we're kind of moving back a little bit, not too far though, I think. So back a few years when she first started professionally doing landscape architecture, she worked from the upper floor of her mother's brownstone home on East 11th Street in New York. Women at the time were excluded from public projects, so her first designs were all residential gardens.
Oh, okay.
Which works out when you live in a wealthy neighborhood.
Yep, there we go. Yeah.
So with the help of her mother and her aunt, Edith Wharton, and their social connections, she was introduced to a lot of prominent people, you know, really leaning into this.
That's okay. Work those connections, okay. Girl.
And which led to her working on a variety of significant projects. And within a few years, she was so prominent in her field that she was chosen to be the only woman among the founders of the American Society of Landscape Architects.
Amazing.
Yes. However, her entire career, she actually preferred the British term landscape gardener. Oh. And so she went by that instead. I can kind of see why in a lot of ways. Like, landscape architect implies a lot more like hardscaping, like rocks, mm-hmm. stairs, fountains.
And I wonder if because she like came from such a like long line of gardeners, if yeah. she wanted to identify then with that.
I would think so. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Also, a lot of her lineage was like English, Welsh. Yeah. That kind of thing. So I think she just felt a lot more in tune with the idea of being a gardener
yeah. rather
than like an architect.
That makes sense.
And I don't blame her for that. So yeah, she was the first charter member that was a woman. As the years passed and her role of clients grew, she went from Washington to Princeton, Yale, Bar Harbor, and Chicago, wherever her work was, traveled.
So cool.
And did all of it. Some important projects. She did the initial site and planning for the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. in 1899. She also did the walled residential garden Belfield for Mr. and Mrs. Thomas Newfold in Hyde Park, New York, which is now part of the FDR National Historical Site.
Oh, cool.
She also collaborated with a few designers on the construction of service buildings at Dumbarton Oaks. She also worked on a project with the White House. It was for the first Mrs. Woodrow Wilson, Ellen Louise Axon Wilson.
Cool.
She commissioned her to design the East Colonial Garden. It's now been redesignated as the Jacqueline Kennedy Garden.
Hmm.
And then also the West Garden, which is now known as the White House Rose Garden. And so she did designs for that. Then Mrs. Wilson died. And then the second Mrs. Wilson, Edith Boylan Galt Wilson, had its installation restarted and completed in 1916. I don't know, like, what extent that's the same now. I would assume probably pretty close. I know that, like, each president's able to redesign parts of the White House, but I assume they probably keep a lot of the historical parts.
It would seem so silly to me to, like, change the landscaping every time a new president came in, but I do know that they will redecorate.
I think it's stupid they redecorate anyway, but that's a whole other story.
I'm just mad because Alma Thomas, who we talked about at one point, she had a painting in the White House during the Obama administration, and, well.
Yeah, they took it out.
It's not there anymore. Maybe Biden put it back. I don't think so, but maybe.
I doubt it. Say what you will about the Obamas, but they had great taste in art.
Yeah, they did. They had amazing taste in art.
Their portraits, hands down the best ones I've ever seen. Anyways. Way to go. She also had a commission from J. Pierpont Morgan to do their residential grounds in New York City.
Oh, wow.
And that eventually ended up being the Morgan Library and Museum. So pretty much everywhere she designed, it ended up being a prominent place of some kind.
They're like, wow, this is beautiful. We should do something with it.
Yep. Apparently her most notable work was the Dumbarton Oaks Estate. I don't know anything about this, but it's in the Georgetown district of Washington, D.C. It was for Mildred and Robert Woods Bliss. And they said what made it so important was that, like, her design was inspired by her European ventures, especially, like, the Italian Renaissance gardens.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds beautiful. And was focused on having, like, a sophisticated relationship between, like, the architecture and the natural environments. So there would be, like, formal terraced gardens and then step down a slope, and then it's, like, a naturalistic aesthetic around a creek. So kind of, like, a formal down to, like, the natural elements as you move towards the water. Sounds gorgeous. I will be finding and posting photos. So in 1928, her husband accepted the position of the first director of the Huntington Library, which we talked about. So they ended up moving to San Marino, California. She had kind of a hard time finding clientele in California. I kind of get why.
I mean, for one thing, it's just so different from West to East Coast that it's like...
Yeah. I'm like, the climate is entirely different. The aesthetics are entirely different. Mm-hmm. I think at that time, people were still, like, very leaning into the whole cactus situation.
Yeah.
In California, you think mid-century modern, there's a lot of, like, rocks, cacti.
Yeah.
Very different from, like, lush rose gardens. So fair. But while there, they ended up founding Reef Point Gardens, which was this independent, educational, and philanthropic corporation. It was meant to just, like, educate, help with plants and gardening and everything else. And it became, like, a big deal in the area. She had a couple commissions with an astronomer, George Ellery Hale.
That's cool.
And architect Myron Hunt. So they worked on a couple of projects for that. She also ended up working with a lot of college campuses. So she did Occidental College and then Caltech did some landscaping around them. Because of, like, the clientele situation in California, she would also travel by train across the country for design projects in the East Coast. That sounds like a very long journey.
Yes.
But she got to work on a garden for Abby Aldrich Rockefeller. I'm sure that name sounds familiar.
Yes.
In Seal Harbor, Maine, and it was a Chinese-inspired garden, which sounds really cool. Those are still very popular, like Asian gardens today. Very gorgeous. Oh, here's one that's fun. Do you recognize the name Harkness?
Yes, I do recognize the name Harkness. My eyes just got very big.
Yeah. She worked on a project at the Harkness Summer Home in Waterford, Connecticut.
Oh.
So I think that's a different one than the one Taylor Swift owns, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Hers is the one in Maine?
In Rhode Island.
Rhode Island, okay. So she worked at their other home, Waterford, Connecticut.
Well, that is still very cool.
Yeah, it's called Eola, I think. And now that estate is actually preserved as the Harkness Memorial Estate Park.
Oh, wow.
So that's the garden she worked on. And then also the one she collaborated with for the Rockefeller's estate in Seal Harbor, Maine. I think that's also preserved. She ended up working with Edith Wharton on landscape and garden design. So her aunt for the Mount Wharton's home in Lenox, Massachusetts, which is open to visitors as well from May to October. And then Henry James introduced her to Theodate Pope Riddle, who she called one of her most fascinating clients, who owned the estate Hillstead, which is now the Hillstead Museum in Farmington, Connecticut.
Wow.
I'm telling you, literally everything she did turned into...
It becomes a museum.
Yeah, and I think part of it has got to be that they're just like, this is gorgeous. Let's choose this house.
Like, I think this is the one that will represent us well.
Back to Reef Point. So Reef Point collection has, like, all of her drawings. It has her herbarium specimens. That's where they, like, put them in those little glass cases. And so people can learn how to identify the different plants. Those are all archived there. And as a part, and they're a part of the University of California, Berkeley campus. And then it also has a lot of the Arnold Arboretum drawings in their archives that are under the stewardship of Harvard, but, like, connected to the University of Berkeley. So all of her studies, like, everything she did ended up being thrown into a part of, like, the program once it was established for these prominent universities of landscape architecture.
Yeah, wow.
Which is really cool to me because especially right after she died, talk about how popular the career became for women to start becoming more a part of it, even though now the ratio is still off. I think it's, like, 30%.
I feel like that's still better, though, than a lot of fields we cover.
Yeah, it definitely is. But for women to be able to go into their program and then see, like, all these drawings and, like, specimens and everything gathered by a woman, like, that's really cool. Her husband ended up dying in 1945, and she dedicated the rest of her life to carrying out plans that they discussed. So she established a Max Farrand Memorial Fund to help carry out the rest of the work at Reef Point Gardens, since they worked on that together, which I think is really cute because, like, she loved gardens and he loved research and, like, libraries. And so what did they do? They created a research library for gardening.
Yeah, that is very nice.
And then with unfailing interest and help of those around her, the house was remodeled, structural changes were made, furnishing changed. reference and old book libraries were installed and cataloged. The grounds were altered to be used for their intended use. And in her old age, she saw more clearly that the changes that affected the whole world were bearing on her enterprise that she and her husband had started. So she ended up changing the Reef Point project to another setting, and then were able to lead that forward to have it become a part of the university and be a valued addition. So she did a ton of work after on this to make sure that it stayed a part of everything. In 2014, she was recognized for her work designing the Peggy Rockefeller Rose Garden, which is now part of the New York Botanical Garden, which was a site also of the Built by Woman New York City.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, which was a competition by the Beverly Willis Architecture Foundation to identify outstanding and diverse sites and spaces designed, engineered, and built by women. So that's another cool thing that you can look at for even more insight on the women who helped plan and build this country.
Yeah, amazing.
Like I said, she did a lot of college campuses. She was a consulting landscape architect for Princeton University. One thing that she really did with that university was like use upright and climbing plants so that the small spaces between buildings wouldn't feel even smaller by putting plants in them. So I think that's where a lot of like the ivy covered walls come from.
Yeah,
like bricks and everything that are known on like
and that's East such Coast. Like an academia like aesthetic now.
And then also her designs were very heavily praised for their practicality, simplicity, and ease of maintenance, which is a really important thing if you're going to have a landscape design. Most people don't want to spend thousands and thousands of dollars maintaining gardens. She also was the consulting landscape architect at Yale for 23 years, working on the Marsh Botanical Garden, and then went on to improve dozens of other campuses, and that included University of Chicago, Southern California's Occidental College, Caltech, Pennsylvania State School of Horticulture for Women, and also was the landscape consultant to Arnold Arboretum, which we, which was cool because that's where she studied.
Yeah.
With the last part of her life. So after like devoting all that time to like the Reef Point Center.
Yeah.
She also published a Reef Point Gardens Bulletin every year and like talking about the progress of the gardens and the center. There was a wildfire that caused some lack of funding and led to some problems, and that ended up having them sell the building, dismantle the garden, and use the proceeds for the last few years. They sold the plants to John D. Rockefeller Jr., who purchased all of them and moved them to Maine, where they continued to flower. And then 2,000 herbarium specimens were given to the University of Jepson Herbaria at University of California, Berkeley, where they continue to be a permanent record of her plants. So kind of a bummer about that. Wildfires suck, you guys. She received a lot of honors during her lifetime, which she considered to be extremely important to her. She got an honorary degree of Master's of Arts and rank of professor, which was given to her, especially when she was a consulting landscape gardener to Yale University. I think they recognized her, like, the program didn't exist. If it did, you wouldn't have been allowed to be in it anyway. So, like, here, we'll give you a degree.
But, like, obviously you know what you're doing because we are having you do this.
A lot of other institutes and colleges followed suit. Smith College gave her an honorary doctorate of letters. Oh, the American Institute of Architects made her an honorary member. And the Garden Club of America gave her her Medal of Achievement. Later still, the New York Botanical Garden gave their Distinguished Service Award and the Massachusetts Horticulture Society their large gold medal.
Wow.
It emphasized many times that she felt her life had been a happy one. She was grateful for what it was given her. She was ever thankful for the affection and help of friends and associates during her long life and attributed much to having the privilege of their guidance, which makes sense. Yeah. How many people played such an important role in her life? She lived and spent the last 3 years of her life at Garland Farm, the homes of her friends Lewis and Amy Magdalene Garland, and that was in Maine. It was here that she created her final garden, which was this intimate space, keeping with the size of the property, and she ended up passing away at age 86 at the Mount Desert Island Hospital on February 28th, 1959. The Garland Farm was later purchased by the Beatrix Farren Society in 2004. The Society's mission is to foster the art and science of horticulture and landscape design with emphasis on the life of work of Beatrix Farren. It actually continues today. They have a website. They publish a newsletter every year. And they have, like, garden experts come and do, like, blog posts and stuff. And I think you can go visit. And it plans to continue Reef Point's original educational mission, as well as preserve Garland Farm and her final garden. So kind of taking on the stuff that wasn't able to finish with Reef Point. Yeah. And that's her. I feel like I was a little sporadic on this. I don't understand a lot of the garden terms and that, but...
No, that's okay. You know what I was just thinking is I'm like, you know what? It is honestly just kind of nice to have a story that's not just like marked by tragedy.
Yeah.
You know,
no, like, this is just a beautiful story.
This is just a nice story of a woman artist that we don't know a lot about, but she was championed in her lifetime. She was appreciated. She had a wonderful marriage, it sounds like. Like, this is what we want more of. And I'm just like, wow, that was so wholesome and good. Yay. Yeah.
And I was like, and it took a couple of years after her death, but she has a whole foundation that's focused on continuing her life's work. And
it's great.
It is. It's great. It's wonderful. I love a happy story.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, when we do this, we don't get a lot of those stories of like, yeah, and they were really appreciated her and made sure she was recognized and protected her legacy. Like, this just feels like I don't know about her, mainly because I just don't know about architecture, like landscaping, period. It seems like in the landscaping world, if you're in the know, that you might know about this lady. And that feels great.
Yeah, I mean, there is a documentary about her called Beatrix Farren's American Landscapes, a documentary film. I think it focuses a ton on the gardening. So you can see some pictures of that. And there's also like quite a few books. I know I got my mom one that had like a lot of pictures, but there's also one that's focused on like her writings. They have like her bulletins from Reef Point. Like, she is very celebrated and established in this area, and it's really nice.
It is really nice. Yeah. I love it. Well, thank you for sharing her story. What an uplifting continuation of this July. So, thank you.
I know. I thought it would be a fun one. And, of course, I'll be posting pictures.
Oh, yeah.
They're gorgeous. Please do. I love looking at gardens.
Me too.
They're just pretty.
Well, thank you again for the uplifting story. And we're here every week with a new woman artist to cover. Some have happier stories than others, unfortunately. But yeah, if you're a fan of the podcast, leave us a review and come back next week because we'll have an episode that I'm particularly excited about. Very on brand of the rest of the world, to be honest. Everyone seems to be celebrating the occasion. So come next week, see what we're talking about.
It's July. We've been ready. It's gonna be a national holiday by next year.
We're ready, okay? That's all.
We're so ready.
We will be back next week, so come back and we'll be here.
We'll see you then. Bye.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.